Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. My name is Em and today I'll be speaking with BBC News journalist and presenter Jane Hill. In 2018, Jane was diagnosed with breast cancer and needed to take a step back from work for a while to recover. We'll be speaking about what she learned during that time and some of the misconceptions and misunderstandings she still comes across in others who have had a breast cancer diagnosis. Jane, thank you for joining me.
Oh, lovely to be here. Thanks very much, Em.
So I was hoping we could start off by talking about your initial diagnosis and what initially spurred you to seek medical treatment.
I was 49 when I was diagnosed. I had found a lump in my left breast in the summer of 2018. Astonishingly, I didn't actually get that diagnosis until mid-October. There's a story in itself, which we may or may not have time for. But anyway, I saw my GP in the July, was referred to a hospital in London where I live in the August, and then it took until mid-October to get the diagnosis. When I found the lump, in a way, I suppose this is a good thing. I was not at all concerned because in my 30s, I'd had several scares, if you want to call them that. I had had several cysts, in essence, in my 30s. I'd had various biopsies. I was very well used to going to this hospital. I knew the drill. I knew what a biopsy felt like. I wasn't worried. I wasn't scared. And in a way, that was a really good thing because it took so long to get my diagnosis. But for the first few months, I really wasn't worried. And when I found the lump, I mean, I'm afraid you see it as an inconvenience initially. You think, oh, God, that's another day off work to go to the GP. I won't get an appointment, another day off work to go to the hospital. And you just see it as a practical pain to be dealt with, And I suppose that was good because there's no point in being worried until you really have to be. Having said that, once I went through appointment after appointment at the hospital, I think I just kind of knew. I sort of refer to it as female intuition sometimes. And I think it's a bit of female intuition. And I think it's a bit of the fact that I'd been through this process and had had biopsies 15 years previously. And as things progressed and as I had an ultrasound and then they weren't sure and then I had another ultrasound, you just start, I think, to see, you can read people's body language. Yeah. I don't know whether we want to go into the whole story of the diagnosis because everyone's got their own story, but actually you can get bogged down in detail. But it took a very long time. And in essence, when I was told I had it, I honestly, by that stage, was not at all surprised. I cried very, very little because honestly, I think I'd have been more shocked if they told me I didn't have it. I think if they'd said, you're fine, it's another cyst, I would have been in bits because I'd have been so shocked and so relieved and I'd have been in floods. And I wasn't in floods at all because I remember walking into that consulting room. Well, more particularly, I remember the day and I remember the day of the appointment and I remember it was 2 o'clock and I remember vividly all the things I did that day in the run-up and I spent that whole day, I went to get my hair tinted, really pedestrian things. And I remember sitting in the hairdressers at my hair appointment thinking, I think I'm going to be told something really major this afternoon. And honestly, I just remember living through all that. I didn't dither. I made a GP's appointment fairly quickly, but for lots of complicated reasons, it took a long time to find it. When I was diagnosed, they told me it was a 7-centimeter tumor. And I do remember thinking, ooh, that sounds rather big. They didn't say that at the time. They didn't scare me. They didn't go, that's a really large tumour, Jane. I just thought in my own head, that doesn't sound good. That ultimately came to make more sense because I was told it was ductal. And once I'd had the operation and I went for my follow-up just before Christmas, at that point, after they'd analysed everything from the mastectomy, they said, oh, it wasn't ductal. It was lobular. And suddenly that made more sense. So in a way, mine turned out to be a a classic lobular case, if you can ever say any incidence of cancer is classic, at which point my consultant, if she hears this, will be screaming at me saying, I always tell you, Jane, every single case of cancer is different. So I know, I hear you, there is no such thing as a classic case. But there are certain things that are common to lobular breast cancer, which makes up about 15% of all breast cancers, and mine ticked a lot of those boxes. Let's leave it at that.
Yes, I mean, we'll get onto that a little bit later, the kind of specifics of the diagnosis. But I suppose in a way you're saying you almost already had that news in your head. So maybe the immediate shock of it wasn't so much of a shock. But I think the build-up of just you slowly coming to realise that must have had an emotional toll as well, even if it was one that was more drawn out rather than an immediate bad news you weren't expecting.
It was surreal. It was completely surreal because the wonderful consultant who is still my consultant, who I have enormous time for, she's fantastic, and the consultant who gave me the diagnosis, actually, I hadn't seen in the run-up. So this was the first time I was meeting her when she sat me down. And I remember she calls a spade a spade. I really like her manner and her tone. And she just said, well, I'm afraid it's not good news. Mm. But then talked me through all the positives of my case. So you've got the bad news, it's ductal, it's 7 centimetres, but then told me lots and lots of positives. Among them was the fact that there was no sign of it at that stage in my lymph nodes, which again, anyone who's been through it knows is really fantastic news. And I feel very lucky and very grateful for that. Mm. So she needed, because she'd never met me before, she needed to, which once she'd given me the news, she said, well, obviously I do want to examine you myself. I want to have a look, you know, get on the bed, all the things we know about. And I remember at that moment thinking, oh my God, I was right. Mm. This is utterly surreal. And for me, that was the word that kept coming into my head over and over again. I'd sort of thought this was how the conversation was going to go. But of course, there's always that bit of you in the back of your mind thinking, please let me be wrong, please let me be wrong. Of course there is. But equally, when it turned out I was right, it was weird. I mean, just the weirdest, strangest feeling. Mm. But did enable me to stay pretty calm and take on board all the information, and I took lots of notes, and you know, I'm a very factual, organized kind of person. You know, I'm a journalist, I'm interested in facts, I'm very fact driven, and I was, I hope, pretty calm and logical about it all, as much as anyone is. Mm. And then you go home and you sort of digest it in the coming days, as everyone who's gone through it will know. But for a long time, I was pretty calm, actually. And we'll come on to this, but it was other things to do, because it was almost positive that I was going to have a mastectomy because of the size of the tumour. Actually, for me, the hardest thing was finding out about reconstruction or not reconstruction. Mm. And honestly, that was the hardest thing of all. The cancer is so fact-based. Here are the stats. Here's the information. Here's the results of your hormone tests. I can totally deal with facts. The really hard bit was about, should I or should I not have reconstruction? What's right for me? What's right for my body shape? And I was really shocked by how little information there is out there about not having reconstruction. Mm. That's my takeaway from my whole journey. I hate the word journey, but my whole cancer experience of the last 3 years, I am still astonished that the thing that was hardest was finding out what it was like to choose to remain flat, which is what I did. Mm. And I will talk to people about that till the cows come home, because I just think if there's a woman out there who is not sure, I would happily talk to her for hours about it, because I was astonished how there's massive information about having reconstruction, but so little about the choice not to have it. And I'm not judging anyone who wants it. Absolutely, it's a very, very personal, individual decision. But I ultimately, for reasons we might have time to discuss, came to the conclusion that I didn't want reconstruction. I still haven't had it. Very, very happy with my decision. No problems with it at all. And I'm still astonished that there was so little information and guidance about perhaps taking the choice not to. I would have had to have an implant, and not to have an implant, which is something I didn't want. So, and anyhow, I would say it was that the fabulous service, the Someone Like Me service at Breast Cancer Now, that was a lifeline in all of that. And that's how I discovered your charity, because it was an absolute lifeline. And if I hadn't had your wonderful volunteer to talk me through her decision not to have reconstruction, I don't know where I would have got the information. So that is why I'm a massive fan of your charity, and the work that you do is just outstanding, I think.
Oh, that's really lovely to hear. And I hope that volunteer listens to this and knows how much that they meant to you in that. And but I completely hear what you're saying. We've heard it so many times before of the sort of pragmatic sides of breast cancer, where there's like a definitive answer of this is the type of cancer it is, this is the stage, the grade, this is the treatment that you need. People find that side of things, they've got a straight answer there. They're like, okay, I know what to do with this. It's when things are a bit more nebulous that it becomes a bit more difficult. And I suppose that leads us into talking about the treatment that you have or elected not to have in this case, and how that affected your day-to-day life, as we sort of mentioned a bit earlier before you had to take time from back from work. So yeah, what was it like going through treatment? What treatment did you need, and how did that change your day-to-day?
So I had a single mastectomy. That was early December. I had that. And then in the February, I had 3 weeks of radiotherapy. And having said I didn't cry that much, I'll tell you the day I cried the most, actually, was the day in January when I got a phone call from one of the lovely specialist breast cancer nurses to tell me that I didn't need chemo. And I was gobsmacked. I mean, I was relieved, obviously, thrilled, delighted. I'm not joking. I remember I took the call sitting on my sofa, and I instantly I phoned Sarah, my wife, and I'm sure I was in tears, and I said, oh my God, I feel like I've won the lottery. Because it turned out to be lobular, they sent me for the Oncotype DX test because it was big but hadn't gone into the lymph, which is kind of a curious combination, actually. And so they sent all my stuff off to California, as they do for the Oncotype test. And again, if anyone knows, listening to this, about Oncotype tests, you know that if you get a score below a certain 20-something, I think. But anyway, I had a miraculously very, very, very low score, which means there is a low percentage chance of recurrence. Therefore, the risks and side effects of chemo outweigh the benefits in your particular case, in your specific case. So they said, there's just no point, Jane. You don't need to have it. And oh my God, I sobbed. It was literally one of the best days of my life. I couldn't believe it. And that meant I went straight through to radiotherapy in February. Radiotherapy obviously makes you tired. My skin went very red quite quickly after. They said, oh, you know, it'll go red in the second week. And mine went quite red, I think, after day one. And I did panic a little bit about that. I don't want to say that. I mean, I think I've been very lucky overall in my treatment. Most of it I sailed through very well. But I don't want to equally sit here and pretend that everything's completely fantastic, because of course there are always moments. And that first day of, well, the second day after radiotherapy, and I woke up and I thought, oh my God, it's gone red immediately. Oh, I'm sure this isn't meant to happen, you know. And you think, oh, did I have too much? What happened? Yeah. You know. And again, the radiotherapy team, who I saw every day, 5 days a week for 3 weeks, the loveliest, loveliest, most wonderful bunch of people. Just the training they must have, just their manner, their tone, the information they give you, the precision. I mean, they were just spectacular. They were the loveliest people. If I think too much about radiotherapy, I kind of well up, because they were just exceptionally lovely. So, so, so lovely. I think that just the treatment I had, I feel so lucky, so fortunate. Everyone takes their time with you. She gave me a really good examination. She said, well, it is red, you're right, but you mustn't worry, and talked me through it. And we talked about what creams to use. And you feel tired it's sort of like having jet lag. A lot of my tiredness after my mastectomy and the radiotherapy, it honestly felt like being jet lagged. I mean, obviously kind of permanently jet lagged, but it's not horrible or scary. It's just one of those things. You just have to give into it, go to bed, have a sleep when you need to, allow yourself to have a sleep. And that's how I got through it. So, you know, there's a couple of bumpy moments like that, but the staff were amazing and really put my mind at rest. And I mean, I'd gone into it thinking, I'll have to have a year off work because I'll have chemo, I'll lose all my hair. And I had just sort of thought, well, it is what it is. You know, that's just the way it's going to be. But of course, because I didn't need chemo, I only had 5 months off work, which was amazing. And when I went back, I did slightly reduced hours for quite a few months, actually. But I did go straight back to the 1 o'clock news, which is my main job. And every time I saw the nurses for all the checkups after the mastectomy, I remember after one of the lovely nurses, and I went in for one check. Oh, I think it was the checkup where they really make sure all the bandages have gone, because they're meant to dissolve, aren't they? These sort of sticky bandage on your scar, and it's meant to just dissolve, and mine wasn't disappearing. And I went in, I said, "Joy, look, it's still all here, the sticky stuff, what's going on?" And she sort of really worked to get rid of it. But she looked at my scar and she said, "When was your operation again?" And I said, "Oh, it was exactly 5 weeks ago." And she went, "Oh my God, your scar's beautiful. It's amazing. It's amazing." "That's a fantastic scar." I said, "Is it? I don't know."
Oh, she's the expert. You've obviously got a good one.
She's seen a lot of mastectomy scars in her career. And she said, "Well, you're just healing brilliantly." She said, "I can't believe it was only 5 weeks ago. It's healing really, really well." Mm. And she and others said over the course of the many appointments that you have, they said, "Oh, I really think the fact that you've gone into it fit and with a good diet and everything, that's really helped you, because you've really bounced back. I had no problems with anesthetics, no problems with the scars or the stitches." Or going home with a drain isn't nice. Again, I'm not going to lie about the bad bits. You know, the drain was a bit of a pain, but I still went out every day. I can still live quite happily and look after myself, because I've still got one operative side of my body and I'm fine, and I can still make a cup of tea one-handed. It just takes a long time. And I used to think a lot, oh my goodness, about I don't know what you do when you if you have to have both at once, and that's a whole other ball game, and my heart goes out to people who go through that, I must say.
Yeah. And I think especially when you the sort of just domestic day to day of just walking the dog, having a shower, making a cup of tea, these are probably things that when you first find out you have breast cancer, that's not immediately what occurs to you of, oh, this might get interrupted. And I think I know you wanted to talk a bit more about your decision to not have reconstructive surgery. Did that play into that at all? Was it kind of, you know, you were worried it was going to restrict your movement a bit more? You didn't want to have further surgery. What was it that that steered you either towards or away certain options?
Do you know, that's interesting. It was several things. So the lovely consultant who I mentioned earlier, she sort of looked at me and said, "Well, you're very slim, so you'd have to have an implant." And I, of course, at that stage, it's all new. And you think, what else would you do? And of course, as I have subsequently discovered, you know, depending on your shape and size, you can, you know, women will be listening to this who've had their own body fat used to recreate the breast. But there was no doubt that I would have had to have an implant. And as soon as the consultant used the word implant, I thought, ooh, don't like the sound of that. It was mentally that notion of a foreign body going inside me. Again, I mean, everything I say in this conversation, there is no judgment passed on anyone who's made that decision, and I do completely understand women who want to have it. But you know, the nurse sits you down, she talks you through how it works, there's pictures, there's slides, you get to feel the actual sort of implant that they would use. And I'm a gym goer. I've always been an active person. I've always looked after myself physically. And when, fortunately, this was one of the appointments that Sarah was able to come with me. And I remember our metaphor, we were sort of looking at each other in the room as this lovely nurse was explaining, you know, the sort of bits of muscles they cut through, or whatever they cut through up here. This is radio, so this doesn't work so well on a podcast, but I'm gesticulating. I'm gesticulating to the top of where my boob was. And yes, they just cut through a little bit here and then they insert it. I'm thinking, you cut through? Oh my God, am I ever going to be able to do a chest press at the gym ever again? You know, am I ever going to lift a dumbbell? Am I ever going to throw a kettlebell? And all I could think about was my gym activity going to be curtailed by this? And so I asked a lot of questions about range of movement. How much range of movement would I have after that? And I felt, for me, there were a lot of caveats. There was a lot of, well, you know, you'll get back quite a lot and you'll have to do your exercises. And I, at that point, I thought, double whammy of something alien inside me and losing range of movement at the gym. and the fact that an implant has a shelf life. So I would be having this put in me at the age of 49, by definition, signing myself up for another operation to put in a new one and do it all over again in my early 60s, potentially again in my 70s. That's a general anaesthetic. That's a major operation. And that just wasn't for me. There was, and as we left the room, we sort of looked at each other and I said, oh my God, do you mind if I really don't have two boobs? Do you mind if I really don't have an implant? And Sarah just said, oh my God, no, I'm not putting you through that. Oh my God, you know, and that was wonderful and really, really supportive because, I mean, we've had some interesting conversations and in particular, my other gay female friends have had interesting conversations about that in terms of body image. I didn't even think about it actually, but one of them said to me, that's so interesting, Jane. I wonder whether you felt really supported, particularly supported because you're gay. And that's not to say that there aren't husbands and boyfriends out there who are supportive to women who also have to make that decision. I just think a female partner completely identifies and is sitting there. I think Sarah was sitting there thinking, oh my God, because she could totally understand what that would be like for her. And we were so like-minded immediately. And I think, I suppose in her head, she was thinking, well, my God, I wouldn't want to do that. And so there was no question. I look a bit different when I haven't got my clothes on, but that doesn't really matter. And the only people who ever see it are her and medical professionals. And that's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fine. That's fine for us. These things are all context, I would say. I am, again, acutely aware that some women have a much, much harder decision than me. You know, my heart goes out to someone for whom it is a much, much harder decision. Having said there was very little information about staying flat, I think from a medical perspective, I felt very confident in my decision. From a physical perspective, there was no doubt in my mind that I didn't want it. That said, I still really, really wanted to talk to a woman who had been through that decision and hadn't regretted it.
Yeah.
As I say, 3 years on, I don't regret it for a second. I think it's the right decision for me. But it was lovely when I chatted to the volunteer that your charity found. She was, I think, 11 or 12 years down the line. And again, that's what's so brilliant about that Someone Like Me service. They, you know, the Breast Cancer Now matched me with someone who was of a similar age at diagnosis. And crucially for me, was someone who was really into keep fit or, you know, being outdoorsy, you know, and I wanted to know whether not having reconstruction had impacted her ability to live life and walk dogs and go on a bike ride and all those sort of things. And she, it was wonderful, wonderful to be able to talk to her and hear her experiences.
What's coming through is really key is what helped you was having that empathy, was having your wife there who could sort of relate to you in terms of, I'm not sure I would want that happening to my body. And she could kind of put herself in your position, perhaps slightly more easily than a man would be able to. And having the empathy of someone else who'd been through the same experience and can kind of just take you through it. And again, it's not so much the pragmatic side of breast cancer here. It's not a black and white binary answer of this is the right way to go, this is the wrong way to go, this is what's going to happen. I know earlier you were talking about the differences between lobular and ductal. And I think you were quite keen to talk about how the differences between those two diagnoses and how some people, even after they have had a diagnosis of breast cancer, don't really understand the differences between those and how those diagnoses can affect you differently, the treatment that you have, and how important it is to actually have an awareness about the specificities of your breast cancer and how you need to be aware going forward and the risks that those might have for you after treatment.
Yes, I think it particularly comes into play further down the line. And I tell you, I mean, I'm still learning about lobular all the time. Mm. 15% of all breast cancers in the UK are lobular. And yet, it seems to me, it's still very little known, very little talked about. When I was first diagnosed, they actually thought mine was ductal. And I remember the consultant saying, this is good, Jane, it's good. It's good to be like everybody else. You are in the majority. You are a kind of very average cancer. And that's a good thing because it's good to be like everybody else. And then, of course, it transpired I wasn't. And I was in the 15% camp. And for a long time, I didn't even when they said in my follow-up, oh, by the way, it's lobular, I didn't really know what it meant. And I did have to do quite a lot of my own research on that. Mm. And some of that research is scary, because one of the differences with lobular is that it can metastasize to parts of the body that ductal doesn't go. Obviously, that's not a nice thought. It's information I'd rather I didn't know. But equally, I personally, again, in a facts-based job, I think it's important to know, and it's important to know these things just to be aware without being scared. And as I said, it makes sense of the fact that the tumour was so large. That's not uncommon. That's very common, in fact, with lobular. Mm. And it made sense of the fact that this is the really scary bit, unfortunately, about lobular, is it doesn't always show up on a mammogram. And mine didn't. So what's astonishing, isn't it, is I go to the consultant in the August. He presses the lump. He says, I'm 99% sure that's a cyst, but we don't rest on our laurels here. We'll give you lots of scans. Go and have a mammogram. And the mammogram came back normal. And isn't that terrifying to have a 10 centimetres of cancer in your breast and your mammogram still show up as normal? Long story short, I had an MRI, and that's what made it clear. And I sort of hesitate saying that, in the sense that I don't want to scare lots of women who might be just going for their regular 2-3 yearly mammograms and think, listen to this and think, oh my God, a mammogram's never going to show up a lobular. I had this conversation with a specialist at a Manchester hospital. I'm not Manchester, I'm in London, but a woman there. And she said, mammograms do sometimes spot lobular. You know, I don't want you to walk away with the impression that it never finds it. It sometimes does, but because it grows differently, it grows in a line, it doesn't form a lump, it doesn't always show on a mammogram. And I feel super, super lucky. At my hospital in London, there was no question. I mean, it was right. Every year, Jane, every autumn, you'll be having both for the next 5 years. That's just how it is. Mm. And I didn't realise that some women, you know, depending where you live in the country, have to really fight to get the MRI.
Mm. And if you have had other conversations with other people who have had experience, are there any other kind of like common misunderstandings or misconceptions that you've come across? Or maybe even things that you yourself had previously believed or had assumed about breast cancer that just simply didn't play out that way?
The big one that came out of my case was when I was diagnosed, I just had the assumption that I would have chemo. It's interesting, because I wasn't worried about the operation. I wasn't nervous of an operation, and I wasn't nervous about radiotherapy, but I was nervous about chemo, because in my head, my perception of chemo, and again, this might be a stereotype, is that you just feel nauseous all the time. Mm. And of all the side effects of chemo, I thought, oh, I'm going to feel sick all the time and I'm going to be really constipated. And for some reason, those were the two things that had lodged in my mind about what chemo meant. And again, my wonderful consultant, every case is different, Jane, every case is different. And chemo is different for different people, because I was worried about that before I got that wonderful news that I didn't have to have it. And Sarah spoke to a friend of hers who'd been through breast cancer a couple of years previously, who had had chemo. And brilliantly, she obviously was lovely to me and contacted me and said, oh my God, Jane, I wasn't sick once during my chemo, not at all. Mm. There might've been other side effects and I slept a lot and so on and so on. But don't just assume that everyone who has chemo spends their whole time throwing up, because I didn't, not once. And that was a real lesson to me, who thought that I was, you know, so good at researching and so good at finding out all the facts. And that was my own personal misconception. And that was wonderful to hear, actually, because she said that to me before I'd had the news that I, in fact, didn't need it. I suppose the thing about breast cancer is I never felt alone, and I hope that most women don't feel alone, because so many of us have had it. Yeah. And I remember, the day I was diagnosed, that surreal moment, but also my brain just fired off in my head, oh, I'm going to text so-and-so and I'm going to phone so-and-so and I'm going to talk to so-and-so. And I could instantly think of women I knew, lots of them actually at work, as it happens, who'd been through it. And I thought, I instantly know who I'm going to talk to. And I think there's a community out there because we all, well, sadly, we all know people who've been through it, don't we? So we all know someone we can talk to. And if we don't know someone directly, we know a friend of a friend or and it sets off a chain. And when I told neighbours in the area where I live, and lovely friend of our neighbour of ours said, oh, my God, Jane, my sister had that a few years ago. I'll put you in touch. And there were lots and lots of connections like that and lots of people offering up support. And I think you play it forward because I've never forgotten how helpful and how supportive that was in the early stages. And I now do the same. And I've now had, again, lots of women through work come to me, friends of friends in the last year, people I didn't necessarily know, but friends say, oh, someone I work with in my department, it's happened to them, Jane, would you mind having a chat with them? And oh my God, I never, ever mind having a chat. I will talk to anyone about it if it's helpful and if it provides support, because I remember how wonderful that was in the early stages. And you know, play it forward.
Yeah. I mean, just the last thing I want to talk to you about is it's quite interesting as well that you say you're quite happy to talk to anyone about this, and that is so wonderful that well, I mean, in a way it's terrible that there are so many people that do have this experience that can talk about it.
Yes.
But it's also wonderful that we're now at a time when there's not so much stigma and that people are happy to talk about it and are happy to sort of offer that comfort to someone else and just have that voice of experience to tell other people what they can expect. But given that you are someone who's somewhat in the public eye, I mean, when I was having a look around to just try and look into your background of your experience and your treatment before we were speaking today, a lot of places framed your diagnosis and said that you kept it a secret at first. And that's probably just... Yeah, and that's probably just a sort of tabloidy way of getting some people reading that. But yeah, are there any thoughts that you had about that? Because I think there is this expectation, if you have had breast cancer, that you are meant to sort of come out and talk about it in a way.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, you've done Googling that I haven't.
No, and I think it's probably for the best.
I never Google myself ever. But keep it a secret. I mean, that's really cheeky, isn't it? Or to put that in English, private.
Yeah.
Let's remember that. Although that's quite interesting, actually, because I did think about, you know, what was I going to say? Obviously, you have to think about how you frame it when you tell your boss, all those sort of questions. So when I was diagnosed, I thought about it. I thought, do I want to be one of those people who instantly goes on Twitter, tells everyone, does something that says, follow my journey? Again, not judging anyone who does go down that route, and women are still doing that today, and that's fine. You know, if that's their way of dealing with it, we all have different ways of dealing with it. I thought about that, and I very, very consciously took a decision not to talk about it immediately. So when I told my boss, I said, within the newsroom, this is not a secret. Tell who you like. I've not done anything wrong. There's nothing to be ashamed of. People need to understand why I'm taking a few months off. Mm. It is not a secret. But I said to him, I am not putting it on Twitter. I am not, you know, giving newspaper interviews about it until I've come through the operation and the treatment. And I took that decision very specifically because I thought, hopefully all will be well. Hopefully the operation will go fine. You know, I'm slim, I'm fit, I'm in good shape. There's no reason this won't go well. However, do I really want to be saying, follow my journey, I'll give you weekly or bi-weekly updates. Mm. And then, God forbid, you know, the surgeons go into the operation and they go, oh, actually, it didn't go as well as we wanted, Jane, or we found something we didn't know about. And then you've set yourself up to, you've sort of promised this diary update, and maybe you don't want to talk about that lump on the other side that they've just discovered that nobody knew was there or whatever. Mm. And I thought, I don't want to put myself under pressure. So my operation was the first week of December, and I went back on air in TV terms in the May, and my first day back was on the 1 o'clock news, and I didn't say anything, and I went back normally, and I did the program. And then when I got home later that day, I just put a little line on Twitter that basically said, big thanks to the NHS. This is why I've been off for the last 5 months, but I'm delighted to be back at work. And I basically said that. But after that, it wasn't secret. In fact, I went on Lorraine on ITV to talk about it. So that's not my definition of being secret. The program asked because they just wanted to talk about the treatment. And I said yes, because I thought if I can say anything that's positive or encouraging to women who are watching this who've just been diagnosed, then brilliant, and I'll do it. And I did go on. For example, I feel very passionately about the whole issue of having a mastectomy and not having reconstruction, because I think there's a lot of issues out there about women's body image and some women feeling scared because they, you know, I've read interviews with women who said, I feel like they're taking away part of my womanhood. And I'm not criticizing or judging those women who feel that way. That's their honestly held opinion. But I'm no less a woman because I had to have a mastectomy. I look at my scar and I think that's the scar that means I'm still here, hopefully for years and years and years. And I can still be a journalist and a friend and an auntie and a godmother. And you're not a lesser person because you have had to have a breast removed. So I feel very strongly about that. So that's why I went on Lorraine to talk about that. So I wasn't being secretive at all.
No, as I say, I think that's probably just getting a few extra clicks on a certain unnamed publication. But yeah, most people would just experience their diagnosis, their treatment, as you say, just in private. That as it wouldn't be framed as a secret.
Yes, in private, just in case it doesn't go the way you want, you know.
Yeah.
And I do remember sitting on the chair, you know, on air and saying lots of positive things. And I wanted to say them and I meant them and they were real. You know, I was saying, if you've just been diagnosed, please, I know it sounds mad, but please try not to be too scared, because there are lots of things about my treatment that were nowhere near as bad as I'd anticipated, nowhere near as scary. The recovery process after the mastectomy was nowhere near as painful. I mean, I thought I was going to be dosed up to the eyeballs on mega painkillers for months. None of that came to pass. You might not need mega painkillers. I didn't. Not everybody does. And so I wanted to go on and give a positive message to women who were about to go through it, because there are lots of things that will honestly, I think, be nowhere near as daunting as you might imagine. Always talk to your breast cancer nurses at the hospital. They've been brilliant. They're the wealth of information. And again, I can't say it often enough, and I mean it. That's why I really was so happy to take part in this podcast, because Breast Cancer Now was an absolute lifeline. The Someone Like Me service was outstanding. And just the helpline, actually, they have been wonderful, because I spoke to them in the early days. But, you know, I've had a couple of bumps in the road, as we all do. Couple of panics about recurrence. I won't lie. We all have that from time to time, I think. We wouldn't be human again if we didn't worry about it coming back. And those are the people that I phone up when I have those wobbles, and they talk you through things. They listen to you. They never hurry you. And I just think the demand for that service must be huge. But the number of times I've had a chat with them and I think, oh, I'll only take up 10 minutes of your time. And as you can see, I can really talk, and it's never 10 minutes. It's always 45. And they're wonderful. Bless them. They never hurry you. You never think they're thinking, oh, I need to take another call, Jane. And they always try and help you in the best way they can. And just free, available, confidential advice at the end of a phone line. I kind of couldn't believe it. And I used to get quite teary, actually, when I used to think about how amazing it was. And all the friends I know who've been diagnosed since, one of the very first things I say to them is, you must talk to Breast Cancer Now, because that helpline is a goldmine and a godsend, and you must get in touch with them. And that's always one of the pieces of advice that I give. So thank you very much to all your volunteers who are brilliant, and everyone who works on that helpline, because they're just brilliant. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jane. That's so lovely. Like,
and I don't cry about this very often, so there you are. Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Oh, that's truly wonderful. I've got to pass this along to our helpline nurses as well.
Yes, you must.
Oh, thank you so much, Jane, for telling us about your experience, and for shouting out Breast Cancer Now, I think, in a way that better than I could do. And anyone listening, if you want to find Jane on social media, she's on Twitter at Jane Hill News. But yes, thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Em. I've really enjoyed it. And thank you again to the charity and everything you do.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe via your preferred podcast provider so that you never miss an episode. Also, if you're able to, we'd love it if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend us to someone you think would find us helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them.